It's Last Quarter from WVTF. I'm Josh Jackson. What a tremendous opportunity to be able to speak with pianist Henry Butler. He's a great conversationalist. He sees the world, or shall I say perceives the world, in a very important way. As an artist, as a thinker, and as a mystic. We'll talk to Henry Butler on this edition of Last Quarter, a pianist who grew up in Louisiana, absorbed the cultural influences around him, and took it in his own direction. What more could you ask from a musician? Henry Butler joins us from a studio in Manhattan. Took him an hour and 40 minutes to get there from his home in Bushwick in Brooklyn.
Josh.
Henry Butler.
How are you, man?
I'm fantastic, sir. How are you?
Boy, technology is wonderful, isn't it?
How about that, huh?
I'm good, man. It's great to hear your voice. I hadn't seen you in a long time.
It has been a couple of years now. I love hearing this band. I had an opportunity to hear you early on in the process with this group, both at the Jazz Standard in New York and then when you played at, I think it was the Brooklyn Metro Tech Center.
Yeah, an outdoor thing.
Right, an outdoor thing. You had sort of a peach-colored getup, which was real nice.
Well, that's good. Well, the band has grown a lot since you heard them. Musically, the band has grown a lot.
How do you determine whether or not something grows musically? What does that mean specifically to someone who may not have the experience of, say, a musician?
Number one, the choice in music, the choice in the repertoire that you're working with, and the way you choose to play it, and the facility that you use or that you have for playing it. There's nobody in New York doing exactly what we're doing right now.
Well, that's a good thing, typically.
Well, we like that. We like that. It makes us fairly unique. Now, I would say that the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra is a good ensemble. Their whole thing is very different. I mean, they change when they need to. But we're focused on pretty much framing our music on a New Orleans foundation. It's almost like New Orleans and beyond. That's fun for me.
I bet it is.
Yeah.
You know a few things about New Orleans music. I'm assuming when you say that you're doing something from a New Orleans perspective, that you're dealing in a lot of ways with the rhythmic foundation of what we call jazz music or improvised music itself.
Yeah, that, I mean, if we're not playing a New Orleans piece, we might infuse a bit of a New Orleans flavor, and there are lots of New Orleans flavors we can infuse. If we're playing a New Orleans piece, like, say, Kid Ory or Louis Armstrong piece, then we try to take it beyond that. We try to infuse more New York-type flavors. You know, almost anything that we play, we try to find a different flavor that we can bring in as a contrasting element and just to make it a little more interesting to both of us, me and Steve.
Steve Bernstein is who you're referring to. From what I understand, the way he started to begin the process of arranging a lot of this music is that he was listening to you and sort of taking some elements and some distinctive things that you do as a performer and a musician and incorporating those things into the arrangements of these songs. And so if that's true, I wonder from your perspective, what does that sound like to listen to yourself or to hear certain aspects of a larger ensemble playing not necessarily licks, but things that you're accustomed to doing yourself, hearing them come back at you?
It's a challenge. It's fun, but it's a challenge to figure out other things to do. And sometimes we have to say to Steve, look, this is getting too crowded here. give me some space so I can do something, right? And it works. I mean, we have a good rapport with each other, and it's fun. I mean, It's fun to make music.
Why?
Well, first of all, for me, it's always been fun to tap into my creative energies. It seems to lift me to a different place as long as I'm doing that. And then when I'm done doing that and I have to get back into this worldly, sometimes stressful material plane, it's not always that much fun. I love going there. I love practicing. I love creating, writing stuff. And the same thing with performance. One of the reasons why it's fun in performance is you're not only tapping into your energies, but you're tapping into the energies of the audience. They're sending energies to you so that you, the performer, can use them in your continuing creativity. And then you send that energy back. But it happens so fast so that within nanoseconds, you're doing stuff back and forth with each other. That's fun. That's great. So that they have an idea of where you are as a performer. You have an idea of what they will accept as an audience. And you have an idea of where you can bring them as listeners.
I feel like it's an important point to make right at this juncture that we're having this specific conversation, Henry Butler, where we let the audience in on something, and that is, you know, the audience can't see either you or I. They're listening to this conversation. You are in New York, and I'm in Virginia, so we can't see each other. And so I think it's important for everyone to know that were we all in the same room together, you could not see any of us because you're sightless. So I'm wondering, when you talk about perceiving something from the audience, how is that information transmitted to you specifically?
Oh, good question. If you were talking to a person who wanted to become mystical in answering your question, they might say that the energies actually are interpreted through the pineal gland, and then it actually reaches the material consciousness, the brain, and et cetera. So I would say that we are conscious as much as we can be around us. And when we're performing, I like to think that I am conscious of how people are feeling about what I'm doing. I like to feel that by the time it gets to my brain, my mind, cells of my conscious physical being, I can translate it and make something happen from it.
Do you feel like you've been put in a situation based on your inability to see, which, you know, visual is such a dominant sense for many who have it, obviously? Do you feel like it's forced you into having to concentrate more?
I used to do camps for blind kids until Katrina happened, and then the facilities were devastated. But we used to do informal surveys and informal testing with blind kids, totally blind kids, and partially sighted kids. And we would test them on their concentration skills. And it always turned out, and again, this was informal testing, the totally blind kids were better at and quicker at coming up with what they needed through their concentration efforts. We surmised that that was the case because they didn't have that extra barrier. Now, sight is a very wonderful and powerful gift, but we don't learn to really use it. Most people don't learn to really use it wisely, and they don't always learn to use their eyes or train their eyes like, say, many artists might use their eyes, visual artists. So they wind up getting taken off track many times, and they have to be helped to get back to the concentration track. So I don't know if I was ever forced to do anything like that, because I was born pretty much without sight. So I was able to craft my life in such a way that I could develop and explore and be lively without the need for sight.
You sound like you made a very specific case. Tell me if I'm reading this incorrectly, where you talk about the perception of an artist versus maybe someone who is not that, and that being sort of a case between the difference between sight and insight.
Sight can become insight, or sight can be fused with insight based on training, based on intellect, based on experience.
Let's talk about some of your early training. You attended the Louisiana
State School for the Blind, yeah.
Okay. But it was during a time where there was a differentiation, I think, between races in Louisiana. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Was there a differentiation in what you believe to be the education and what was afforded to you in terms of training?
Well, one of those, fortunate for me, cases, we found that our school had a stronger academic setting, and we knew that it had a stronger musical setting, partly because our teachers could not go to the white school at the time, which was LSU. So they wound up getting their advanced and doctoral degrees from Big Ten schools and schools that had way more academic credibility than LSU at the time. They also understood what our basic life needs were, and they really showed a lot of care in helping us to develop into fairly literate and educated people.
Well, let's flash forward some 60 years now, Henry. What are some of your basic life needs at this point?
Knowing me better, knowing how to live more artistically, and trying to attune to any environment that I'm in so that I can maybe give some of the people in that environment a little more, maybe sometimes some of what they need, and I can be nicer to myself.
Are you a little worried that, you know, now that you're in your mid to late 60s, you're starting to get to this point of veneration where people start to talk about you in these terms of being one of the old masters, not in the Dutch painting senses, but in the form of a New Orleans musician specifically, someone who's really played a lot of the tradition and also a lot of the music that is so much a part of that city. So does it concern you a little bit that people are starting to talk about you like you're one of those guys in the Pantheon?
You know, I figured, you know, when I was younger, I figured it would come sooner or later. But I don't think about it that much. I'm always trying to better my offering, my renderings, my service to humanity, and I'm always trying to have a little bit more fun doing that. I don't worry about what the press and what, you know, all these people say about me, although I do appreciate the fact that they've been really good to me for most of my life. I can't worry about it. There's too much to do. There's too much time to... Well, there's not enough time to do all the things that need to be done. So fortunately, I've never had to look for praise for me. And I'm grateful that it's been there for a lot of my career.
Did you feel a slight tinge that maybe a little bit of New Orleans died when Alan Toussaint passed away?
I felt that he obviously was a very prolific composer and arranger and all of that, pianist. There's certainly nobody down there that replaces him. Yes, I do feel that a little bit of New Orleans, I won't say died, but just left.
Left.
Yeah, just left the city, just left the earth, you know, so to speak.
Are you concerned that the lineage is starting to break a little bit in that city culturally for whatever reasons? Katrina, gentrification. I mean, you can pick a lot of things that are real stressors, I think, on the culture bearers of that city. But, you know, as a lot of people have sort of looked at you and described you in terms that related you to either Alan Toussaint or Professor Longhair or Toots Washington, all of these great pianists, all these great musicians in the city, are you concerned that that lineage is potentially going to break?
Well, I think it's probably breaking already. Unfortunately, they've had politicians who didn't really support the culture. There's all sorts of reasons, as you said. I think when they realize that it's that the culture is gone, it's going to be a sad city because there's really nothing else. I mean, the food relates to the music relates to the food. It's all sort of intertwined. And when the cultural essence isn't there anymore, you'll also see a break in the tourism. I don't think there'll be no need for people to go to New Orleans. There'll be many other locations that are offering unique things. It makes me sad to see that there is that possibility.
Henry Butler joins us here on Last Quarter. Jelly Roll Morton.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of music here on the recording, Viper's Drag from Henry Butler and Steve Bernstein and the Hot Nine. You deal with a lot of Jelly Roll's music. And, you know, he was one who was certainly given the gift of maybe a tad bit of hyperbole in some ways. But he had a lot of swag, did he not?
He did. And he was very confident. But he had something to back it up. He was also able to take from some of his contemporaries and use that, infuse what they were doing, like Joseph Lamb and Tony Jackson, all those guys that we probably will never hear play. Well, we certainly won't, because they didn't really leave anything on paper, or they weren't able to be recorded. So we have his insights of their playing and musical understanding coming through his works. We arranged, and I helped Steve with this, King Porter Stomp, Wolverine Blues. You know, Jelly Roll was a hell of a player, man. You know, he did some great solo stuff too, like the Finger Buster piece. It really is a finger buster. I don't mind his cockiness, as long as he was able to give us something to study and to work with, to grow with, that kind of thing.
Tell me how you listen to music, Henry Butler. Like, if you put on a Jelly Roll Morton record, describe what's happening inside of Henry Butler's head.
Well, the first thing I like to do is not to truly be analytical. So the first thing I want to do is just to listen. I want to perceive. I want to listen with my ears, my physical ears. I want to listen with anything else I might have. And after I listen maybe to a piece or to a whole CD once, then I want to go back and start maybe analyzing a little bit. I've been doing this for a long time, so it's become a lot easier to figure out the different sections and maybe what's being done and maybe how he came upon doing whatever it is he's doing. Also, because I know the culture, you know, I mean, I know the New Orleans culture from Jelly Roll on up through Trombone Shorty and beyond. Well, there are a lot of elements that are the same throughout that culture, whether it's blues or gospel or trad or, I mean, there's certain licks that you can hear in almost every player down through the decades, and they still work. They still work. I'll give you an example. Jelly Roll did, was it Shreveport Stomp for solo piano, and there's a lick in there.
Sounds like you just did the mess around.
Well, that's all I was going to say, see? Well, so forward that about 50, 60 some years, Ray Charles is living in New Orleans for 2 or 3 years, and he brings that out on, I think it was one of his Atlantic recordings, The Mess Around. And it really, it just works, man. It just works. I like following people. I like following the Jelly Rolls and the Ray Charles, especially his stint in New Orleans, which changed him a lot. And I love listening to the rhythms of piano players coming from New Orleans because they're very different, especially in the R&B, as I would say, the rhythmic blues composers and performers. I don't like using R&B anymore because, first of all, in our music, you can't really separate the rhythm from the blues.
Mm. Something you talked about when you were talking about knowing New Orleans music, and I know that's come through, obviously, a lot of study, a lot of you literally performing this music. But I wonder what your thoughts are about, can someone sort of know a culture like that intrinsically? Can someone just feel that without knowing any of that information?
Yes.
How?
Yes. A mystic might say...
You keep talking about a mystic like it's somebody else. What about you?
Well, I'm a student of mysticism,
okay.
and that's why I say it like that.
I see.
And I actually got that. Alvin Batiste was the one that introduced me to mystical study.
Rosicrucianism.
Through the Rosicrucians, yes. So I would say many mystical minds would say that if you've lived a life in Africa or lived a life in Mesopotamia or that's now in the area of Iraq, you would know something about that music and you would know something about that culture. If you've lived a life as a slave, say in New Orleans, and you may have found yourself going to a Place du Congo or Congo Square, you would know, you would have some idea intrinsically of the short motifs that might have been sung in Congo Square. I know Gottschalk talked a little bit about hearing the short rhythmic motifs that were sung repeatedly, probably as they were dancing. I'm not sure if I was a slave or not. Yes, intrinsically, to answer your question, you can know something about different cultures before you even study it. Many of the jazz performers, you know, especially starting in the 1920s through now, were not very literate, but, you know, they were very musical.
You're talking about cultural literacy versus actual literacy, the ability to read?
Both. They were not necessarily culturally literate in the sense that we might think of that. Sometimes, you know, we pick up a book and read about a culture, and, you know, sometimes we listen to music because of the technology that we have today, but a lot of that wasn't available in the 20s and 30s. But it didn't stop many of those guys from being very proficient musically. You know, they learned from people around them and their elders. Just like a lot of the students that I've had, they come to me with something already. They come to me with the tools. They come to me with the raw material. And I just help them to find ways to put it together, to organize it, to maybe jumpstart it in a different direction, whatever.
Well, now that we have such a potentially literate society and access to an enormous wealth of information, one could maybe make the argument that that doesn't necessarily get us any further in some of these quests to...
Well, we have to be careful that we don't get bogged down in just information. And that does happen. I think the information is not a bad thing. You know, having lots of information is not a bad thing. It's how we decide we want to use it. And the wisdom... at least developing the wisdom to choose the right stuff to use.
I've got time for one more question. You say the word see a lot. What does that mean to you?
It really just means perceive. I just use the language of sighted people to suggest my perception of something.
Well, we look forward to perceiving you as you perceive for us. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Henry Butler.
Same here, Josh. You're good at this, man.
I look forward to us being in the same space, always.
My pleasure.
This is Last Quarter. From WVTF, I'm Josh Jackson.